This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. Thousands of people took to the streets of Hong Kong under the watch of riot police Sunday to demand more democracy and an investigation into the use of force to suppress the six-month-long anti-government demonstrations. The protesters want to keep up pressure on city leader Carrie Lam after pro-democracy candidates won a landslide victory in a district council election a week ago. Iraq's parliament approved the resignation of Prime Minister Adel Abdul Mahdi on Sunday amid ongoing violence and anti-government demonstrations in the capital that saw one protester shot dead. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres delivered a strong statement to world leaders on Sunday ahead of a climate conference in Madrid. Reuters' David Doyle reports.
We are confronted now with a global climate crisis. And the point of no return is no longer over the horizon. It is in sight and hurtling towards us.
With regions on every continent experiencing extreme weather, from wildfires to floods, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres delivered a sharp rebuke to world leaders on Sunday.
Until now, our efforts to reach these targets have been utterly inadequate.
Guterres was speaking on the eve of a UN climate summit in Madrid, at which world leaders will be under pressure to do more.
That's Reuters' David Doyle. A regional bus in Tunisia crashed off a hill Sunday morning, killing 22 passengers. The Interior Ministry says 21 additional passengers are being treated at nearby hospitals. Russian emergency officials say 19 people died Sunday when their bus plunged off a bridge onto a frozen river in eastern Siberia. Another 22 people were injured in the accident. For more news, go to voanews.com. From Washington, this is VOA News. The House Intelligence Committee is wrapping up the investigative phase of its impeachment inquiry into U.S. President Donald Trump. A Tuesday evening meeting is planned to vote on its report. Then the House Judiciary Committee will take the lead as the Democratic-led House pushes closer to a possible vote on charges against President Trump. Democratic Representative Val Demings, appearing on ABC's This Week, says there are no set plans for witnesses who may be called to future Judiciary Committee hearings.
We have not really made the decision on future hearings or future witnesses yet. I think our main focus right now is to have the president and his counsel, who you know are given the same privileges as President Nixon and President Clinton had, to participate and engage in this impeachment process.
Appearing on the same program, Republican Representative Tom McClintock says Republicans should be allowed to call any and all witnesses they want.
In a free society, the prosecution doesn't get to choose what witnesses the defense wishes to call. And yet that's what's been going on in the Intelligence Committee. And again, the question is going to be whether Jerry Nadler continues that sham in the judiciary hearings. When it goes over to the Senate, that's going to play a big role, I think, in the Senate's deliberations. They, I think, will insist on full due process rights, and that could blow up in the Democrats' faces.
Mr. Trump has denied any wrongdoing, calling the impeachment inquiry a witch hunt. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he will toughen sentences for people convicted of violent crime and terrorism if he wins a national election this month. Reuters' Eimear McCarthy reports.
With just under 2 weeks until UK voters head to the polls, security has become one of the election campaign's pressing topics. That comes after a man convicted of terrorism and released early from prison killed two people in London on Friday before being shot dead by police. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party have long championed tough police and prison measures, but opposition parties have criticised the governing party for overseeing almost a decade of cuts to public services. Three people remain in hospital, two of them in a stable condition after Friday's attack.
That's Reuters' Eimear McCarthy. Winter weather is expected to hit the Northeast today, including New York City. The city sanitation commissioner, Catherine Garcia, says they're prepared.
This is a system that has 2 inches of rain in it and has hit the West and the Midwest very strongly. If the freezing line is to our south, we're going to get a lot more snow. If it's to our north, we're going to have a rainy day.
The storm hits as millions of Americans are traveling as the Thanksgiving holiday weekend comes to an end. For news on the go, please download the VOA mobile app. In Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We cannot comment on allegations of fraud. But what is important to underline here is that the president lost 30% of the vote relative to 2014. The president has been re-elected. The focus is to get Namibia a better place for all its citizens and visitors.
Incumbent Namibia President Heidi Geingob wins re-election for his second and final full-year term.
We continue to launch pressure on the ruling party to see sense, to see value in the dialogue. Because without the dialogue, we are certainly headed to catastrophe in this country.
Zambian opposition and civil society groups condemn violence targeting opponents of President Edgar Lungu and his ruling party, the Patriotic Front.
There are two people that refuse and block their own area from going in. We cannot be fighting Zambia from outside. You have to be in to fight him from within. It might take time, but it's the safest way to protect the lives of the people.
And the founder of the Cameroonian main opposition party rejects allegations of threat and intimidation from separatist leaders. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Namibian President Heidi Geingob has been re-elected to his second and final four-year term. The Electoral Commission of Namibia says the incumbent president garnered 56.3% of the total vote cast. Panduleni Itula, who came in second, contested as an independent candidate and got 30% of the vote. Just like the incumbent president, he is a member of the governing party, the Southwest African People's Organization, or SWAPO. Main opposition leader Mark Henry Venani came in a distant third with 5.3% of the vote. For more reaction to the just concluded elections, I reached Dr. Alfredo Hengari, special advisor and spokesperson for Namibian President Geingob.
It is a very important mandate from the Namibian people. The president is reflective enough to know that the mandate is significantly reduced, but at the same time, the president committed to serve Namibians with passion and determination. The challenges are many, because Namibia has been going through an economic recession, which at times makes it difficult to roll out all the ambitions the president had set out to achieve. But the president is very clear that the work that will follow will be very consequential and important.
So with the reduction in the number of votes he got this time around, is it a concern to the president?
The president is ambitious and wants to do the best he can for the Namibian people. And, of course, this time when Namibians voted, the president had a record. And generally in the context in which our public finances were, some of the programs and the promises the president had made could not be fulfilled. So there's no question about the fact that Namibians voted with some of those considerations in mind. I mean, an economy that is not performed optimally, but the president has initiated a number of important reforms on the economic front to make Namibia more competitive, to make sure that future generations are not caught up in a web of debt. President Geingob focused on fiscal consolidation, managing public expenditure, which has been reduced by about 5%, rolled out significant social programs in order to protect the weak and the vulnerable at a time when the economy was not doing so well, doubled the old age pension, rolled out food banks across all the 14 regions, benefiting thousands and thousands of Namibians. So, of course, for Namibians, as they showed at the polls, this was not enough. Of course, this was important because at a time of economic difficulty, it is very important to protect the vulnerable, and the president did just that.
In this second full-year term, after this mandate, after this election, what should the people of Namibia expect from him?
The president will focus significantly on infrastructure, the rehabilitation of our schools. A number of resources will be invested in that. The president will focus on making sure that some of our infrastructures are upgraded, including the international airport. Namibia is in the process of building, you know, rehabilitating the current airport. And the objective there is to make sure that Namibia increases its volumes in tourism because it's a significant contributor to the economy. But without infrastructure, the right infrastructure, you are not likely to see growth there. So the president will focus on infrastructure as a priority area, upgrading our roads. The question of youth unemployment is also foremost on the president's mind. In that regard, programs that are labor-intensive for young people are being planned.
I'm sure you are aware that the losing presidential candidate has alleged fraud during the election. He cited voter irregularities and fraud, which gave or forms part of the process that led to President Geingob's re-election. What is your take on this allegation?
As the president, we cannot comment on allegations of fraud. But what is important to underline here is that the president lost 30% of the vote relative to 2014. The president has been re-elected. The focus is to get Namibia a better place for all its citizens and visitors.
Dr. Alfredo Hengari is a special advisor and spokesperson for Namibian President Haige Geingob. He spoke with me from the capital, Windhoek. Meanwhile, opposition groups have expressed suspicion of the outcome of the election results, citing voter irregularities. The opposition Popular Democratic Movement, or PDM, says there were discrepancies in some of the results the Electoral Commission announced, which they said differed from those in the respective polling stations. The party therefore says it plans to embark on an independent audit of the result. This, as other opposition parties meet in the capital of Windhoek to decide the next steps forward about the outcome of the elections. For more reaction, I read Vipuya Muharukua, parliamentarian from the opposition Popular Democratic Movement, or PDM.
What we are saying is that we, the party that I represent, we are in the process of doing our own audit of the information that is broadcasted for us to be able to determine. So far, we've done a number of spot checks, and these are the problems. The results that are broadcasted weight against the results that the machine printed out, in many instances, do not tally. You would have a different results broadcasted as the result, and when you look at what the machine printed, it's not the same. Then there's another Form 6, which is a handwritten form and posted at the polling station. In some instances, you'd have a result that the ECN has announced, but this result is on that Form 6. That Form 6 does not contain or does not depict a stamp of the ECN at the polling station where it was supposedly done. But in if you look at the actual ECN printout of that same polling station, it does not also not tell you with this purported handwritten Form 6. So that is telling you one thing. Either someone has drafted this thing themselves without having regard to what the EVM has printed out and therefore announced those results. So those discrepancies are the things that we are saying, look, we need to audit more of these results. Remember, the President of the Republic won this election with a 6% difference. So it is cardinal that we audit everything and see that indeed there was no deliberate error in inverted commas.
I understand opposition groups are also meeting to decide the next line of action. Does the next line of action include legally challenging the outcome of the elections?
Yes. The meeting is sitting as we are speaking. The opposition are meeting as we are speaking. Of course, I'm not in a position right now to divulge much of the information that is being discussed in that very meeting. However, we take nothing off the table in terms of our next course of action. Nothing is on the table, including the legal route. A legal route, in my view, would always be the most responsible reasoning. Will always be the most responsible course of action for any responsible citizen who is aggrieved in this sort of manner, because people have voted. People have voted in this country, and it is for us as leaders to ensure that those people or Namibian people get the due vote that they have voted.
Both local and international poll observers, including SADC, the regional bloc that monitor the elections, are saying the elections were free, transparent, credible, and peaceful. Do you doubt that?
Mm-hmm. Look, one wonders what criteria these people use to determine this. Could it be that the mere fact that Namibians by very nature are peaceful people, there's no pull and shoving at polling stations, no party is rubbing shoulders or ruffling the feathers of other parties, and therefore there's no fighting, there's no violence, there's no actual verbal abuse of any form of between the political parties, and therefore that peaceful environment therefore influenced the decisions of these individuals, of these observation groups. Because if you look at it, when did they announce or give their reports as to the election? All of them did so before the election result was announced. Now, how do you determine that an election is credible if you have not even seen the result of that election? It is one thing to say that the election is peaceful. It is one thing to say that it's free. But it's another thing to say that it's credible. Yes, it's free if the media is allowed to broadcast. Yes, it's free if no one is coerced to vote one way or another. But is it free if the government keeps a specific sector of community in poverty and during election time take food to them and tell them that you vote for this party, if you don't vote for this party, this food is not going to come again? Is it free if the government is telling old people that your constitutional right enshrined in the constitution of getting an old age pension grant for every elderly person will be withdrawn from you if you do not vote a specific party? So one wonders whether these groups go to all these corners and attend all these rallies and hears everything that is being said to make this determination. In these examples that I've used are things that are actually happening. But how do you say an election is credible before a result is announced?
You talked about auditing the results that came out or were announced by the Electoral Commission of Namibia, or ECN. Will this audit be done independently by your party or opposition parties, or be done by the Electoral Commission of Namibia or ECN?
Well, we are doing that ourselves. The spot checks that we've done ourselves, and as far as that process at this stage and juncture, we are doing it ourselves until such time that we need to engage the services of experts to dissect various things for us. But at this point in time, we think we have sufficient capacity to be able to audit that ourselves.
Vipuya Muharukuwa is a parliamentarian from the Namibian Opposition Popular Democratic Movement, or PDM. He spoke with me from Vintok. Civil society, opposition groups, and the ruling party, the Patriotic Front, or PF, are condemning the attack of Sean Tembo, leader of the opposition Patriots for Economic Progress, or PEP. PEP supporters accuse partisans of the governing PF of masterminding the attack, accusations supporters of the ruling party deny. Mr. Tembo was attacked while leading a demonstration to protest against allegations of government corruption. For reaction, Charles Kakoma, spokesperson for the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, tells me it is unacceptable for those opposing the government to be attacked.
The attack was barbaric, and it looked like the attack was well-planned by the ruling party, because they managed to hire 6 buses that went to attack this opposition leader. This was after the opposition leader had taken the matter to court for stopping his earlier protest over corruption some 1-2 years ago, and he won his case. So we strongly condemn as the largest opposition party in Zambia, and we draw attention to the whole world that they should watch carefully what is happening in Zambia, because this political violence is escalating, and we are heading towards the presidential and general elections in 2021. And if this political violence is not resolved, there's going to be chaos in Zambia.
Charles, officials have condemned attacks on opposition leaders. Sometimes they have even accused the UPND supporters of fomenting trouble and clashing with the police. So who is to blame here when politically related violence occurs? In this case, some people are demanding immediate independent investigation into the attack on Sean Tembo, the opposition leader. What is the stance of the UPND, the biggest opposition party in Zambia?
Our stance is that we do not tolerate political violence. We have not beaten anyone from the opposition, and We have said we are victims of political violence. The ruling party always organizes its cadres to attack our members. And whenever we report to the police do not take action against the ruling party cadres. The police are scared of arresting the ruling party cadres for fear of losing their jobs. And some of the policemen have actually lost their jobs for arresting these ruling party cadres. So in the absence of police protection, we have told our people that they have the right to defend themselves if they are attacked.
Charles, some people are saying that what is the proof that it is the supporters of the ruling Patriotic Front Party that attacked Sean Tembo?
Well, I think they are just trying to cover up because everybody knows that they are ruling party cadres. The journalists, the media were there and they saw them party cadres. The buses that they used were identified, and they are always at the bus stop called Kurima Tower, which is controlled by the ruling party, and therefore they cannot say that police should investigate. The police will not investigate. They just want the case to die a natural death.
So what is the UPND going to do about this politically related violence in terms of engaging civil society, in terms of engaging the government to resolve this ahead of the 2021 general election?
Well, we have said that all the Zambians, all the stakeholders, including civil society and the church and the other political parties, must unite and fight this political violence. And we have said that we've asked the church to lead in this fight. We've asked the church to chair a dialogue process where we can talk about political violence. And the church has agreed and invited the ruling party to the dialogue process. But the ruling party has refused. So we'll continue to mount pressure on the ruling party to see sense, to see value in the dialogue. Because without dialogue, we are certainly headed
Charles Kakoma is the spokesperson for the Zambian main opposition party, United Party for National Development, or UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Founder of the Cameroonian main opposition party, the Social Democratic Front, or SDF, has rejected alleged intimidation from leaders of separatist groups in the diaspora. John Fruindi says he made several efforts to meet them when he went overseas, but they refused. The leaders accused the SDF leader of working with President Paul Biya's government to undermine their efforts to establish their own country to be called Ambazonia. Main opposition leader John Fruindi tells me he will not allow himself to be bullied by the separatists in spite of the ongoing threats and intimidation.
Well, they said that we are cooperating with Biya to go in for elections. We should not go. We are not supposed to do this and all that. I was in America there, and I called them, please, can we sit down, talk? You convinced me of your program. They didn't do that. I went to Switzerland, still made the same appeal there. I was in Belgium, made the same appeal. They didn't come. But only giving Fruindi wanted to get out of parliament. I said, you cannot dictate to me. Never, never dictate to me. Convince me why you think we should do it this way. Now, they tell the children back home to arrest Fruindi, deal with him, to teach a lesson to others. And you know that they've been cutting people's heads and killing people indiscriminately. So I don't know what's happening.
So what are you going to do about these threats and intimidation that you're talking about? Because going to the authorities could also mean that you are working closely with them. However, you and your family need to be protected as well.
Look, Peter, since they started with the Ambazonian struggle in Cameroon, the government sent word to me that they want to send me security, but I refused because I want to be at a position where anybody who has anything to tell me should feel free, safe, to come and talk to me. Democracy is discussion, negotiation, convincing, and not dictatorship.
What is the progress report that you have after your party held an executive meeting about the upcoming election? Because the government has warned of any plan to boycott the February elections.
No, we decided that we should fight Mr. Biya from within. and that will be going in for this election. But there are some two people that refuse and block their own area from going in. We cannot be fighting Mr. Biya from outside. You have to be in to fight him from within. It might take time, but it's the safest way to protect the lives of the people.
John Fruindi is the founder of the Cameroonian main opposition party, the Social Democratic Front, or SDF. He spoke with me from Bamenda. Sudanese authorities have approved a law to dismantle the foundations of former President Omar Hassan al-Bashir's government. Demonstrators flooded the street in celebration of the new law, which also repeals a public order act used to regulate women's dress and behavior. For VOA, Naba Muhaideen has the reaction from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
Demonstrators chanted at the march in Khartoum Thursday, after Sudan's new ruling sovereign council and the cabinet led by Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok dissolved the party of former President Omar al-Bashir. Minister of Justice Nasruddin Abdulbari, who proposed the law to the minister's council, said the law was passed under the constitutional draft signed between the military and protest leaders. Abdulbari says this law is directed at the National Congress Party and allows the government to seize the NCB's assets and hand them to the Ministry of Finance and Strategic Planning. The demonstrators celebrated what they called a new victory for Sudan. Omar Bob was among those on the streets.
أكيد نحن كسودانيين اليوم ده أزعد يوم في حياتنا إنه نحن أخيرا خلصنا من المنظومة اللي
Bob says, as Sudanese, this is the happiest day. The people finally get rid of the repressive 30-year-old Bashir organization. He adds, this is another achievement of the December Revolution. Tens of thousands of Sudanese began protesting late last year in anger over rising food prices. They demanded reforms and Bashir's ouster. In April, the military removed Bashir and jailed him. Since then, protesters have demanded that his National Congress Party be eliminated. Several other officials of his government and senior party members are also in jail, facing trial on charges of corruption. Under the new law, members of Bashir's government or party cannot take part in any political activity for 10 years. Leaders of the National Islamic Front, joined by the politicians, formed the NCB in 1998. It grew out of the Islamist student activism of the Muslim Brotherhood and advocated Islamism, pan-Arabism and Arab nationalism. Political analyst Al-Fatih Mahmoud thinks the timing of this decision is important to Sudan's current transition.
حل المؤتمر الوطني وإزالة التمكين قرار استراتيجي جاء في وقته تماما.
Mahmoud says the decision to dissolve the National Congress Party is a strategic decision issued at the right time. As the coming phase of political change will determine the directions of the revolution, he says that couldn't happen without dismantling the NCB. The new law also repeals of the Public Order Act Bashir imposed. The Public Order Act mainly was used to regulate women's dress and behavior and applied Sharia law, which had originally been introduced in 1983. The general who led the effort to remove Bashir and protest leaders signed a power-sharing agreement in August and established a joint council to govern the country for 3 years. After that, elections will be held to set a new government. The National Congress Party says illegal government is confiscating party assets because it had not solved the country's economic crisis. Naba Muhaideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the International Day for the Disabled Persons is commemorated on December 3rd. Disability on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
On December 6th, Border Crossings will bring you the greatest songs inspired by the soul genre. You'll hear smash hits from Three Dog Night, Holland Oates, and George Michael. If you like these tracks, you'll love our Soul Inspirations theme. December 6th on The Voice of America.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, nearly one-third of Ugandans' new HIV infections are among 15 to 25-year-olds who say, despite progress, stigma is still a problem. To raise awareness ahead of World AIDS Day on December 1, Uganda holds an annual fashion show and beauty pageant for young people infected with a virus that causes AIDS and calls them the young positives. For VOA, Halima Tumani reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
The pomp, dance and fashion were on display at Uganda's Young Positives pageant this month in Kampala. But the aim of this annual show is not just beauty and talent. It is to fight the stigma and discrimination against young people who are HIV positive. Nicholas Niwagaba is with the pageant organizer, the Uganda Network of Young People Living with HIV and AIDS.
You're HIV positive, you're a moving dead body, or you're promiscuous. So we're trying to change that narrative to say that young people living with HIV or people living with HIV are human beings. We want the community to accept them.
Education on HIV prevention is also a key part of the Young Positives pageant, which displays condoms and promotes safe sex. UNAIDS says about 6% of Ugandans are HIV positive, one of the highest rates in East Africa. But there is progress in Uganda's fight against HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. AIDS-related deaths dropped by nearly 60% in 2018, says UNAIDS. But nearly one-third of the 53,000 new infections was young people between the ages of 15 and 25. Reaching this age group is key to halt the spread of HIV, says the Uganda AIDS Commission's Nelson Musoba.
It matters how the message is packaged and who carries this message. And in the current generation, fashion, music, working with celebrities is one way to transmit the message to the young people. And we find this a very attractive. You can see the attention it's generating. You can see the participation.
19-year-old Taylor Timothy Kabogoza and one of his other five siblings were born HIV positive. Kabogoza says he tried to keep his status a secret, but his friends found out and started pointing fingers.
And for real, I tried to cover up that thing. But when I come back in my room, I'll be like, oh my God, this guy said something, oh my God.
Kabogoza acknowledged he has not always been consistent in taking his antiretroviral medication, but participation in the Young Positives Beauty Pageant boosted Kabogoza's confidence, and at this year's contest, he took second place. Kabogoza says he wants to pass on an upbeat message to other HIV-positive youth. Take your medication, he sings, and stop the self-shaming. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with athletics. Joshua Cheptegei smashed the world record in the 10 kilometers, clocking 26.38 at the 10-kilometer Valencia Trinidad Alfonso, a World Athletics Silver Label road race on Sunday. The Ugandan star clipped 6 seconds from the previous record of 26.44 set by Kenya's Patrick Kamon in 2010 to complete a sensational 2019 hat-trick that included world titles in cross-country and 10,000 meters on the track. This year, Cheptegei has won the World Cross-Country Championships in Denmark, 10,000 meters World Championships in Doha, and now the world record in Valencia. In football, Holders Esperance and former winners TP Mazembe and Mamelodi Sundowns produced victories on Saturday in the opening group matches of this season's African Champions League. Anis Badri and Ibrahim Quattara scored within the first 15 minutes for Esperance of Tunisia, away to Raja Casablanca of Morocco, and held firm to secure a 2-0 triumph. Jackson Mleka scored two goals as Mazembe of the DR Congo overpowered Egypt's Zamalek 3-0 in Lubumbashi. Uruguayan Mauricio Afonso took advantage of a rare start for Sundowns by scoring within 7 minutes of the kickoff to set up a 3-0 win over Petro Luanda of Angola in Pretoria. The other matches between USM Alger of Algeria and Wydad Casablanca of Morocco in Blida and Premio Agosto of Angola and Zesco United of Zambia in Luanda ended in 1-1 draws. On Friday, there were home wins for Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia, Al Hilal of Sudan, and JS Kabylie of Algeria over Al Ahly of Egypt, Platinum of Zimbabwe, and V Club of DR Congo, respectively. Esperance, seeking a record third straight Champions League title, is now in first place in Group D, considered the strongest of the four. TP Mazembe, who won the last of five Champions League titles in 2015, followed up with birthday celebrations this week by dominating Zamalek, who have also been champions five times. Meanwhile, Egyptian club Zamalek confirms it will not travel to Qatar to play Champions League holders Esperance of Tunisia in February's Africa Super Cup. The annual match brings together the winners of the African Champions League and the Confederation Cup. Zamalek president Motada Mansour said at a press conference on Tuesday, in his words, "We are African teams. Why should we play in Asia?" Last year, CAF decided that the Super Cup would be played in Qatar until 2021, rather than the tradition of the Champions League winners hosting the match. Morocco's Raja Casablanca, the Confederation Cup holders, beat Esperance in last year's match in Qatar. And five times African champions TP Mazembe of DR Congo are celebrating their 80th anniversary. As part of the celebrations, the club president Moise Katumbi announced on Thursday plans to construct a 50,000 capacity stadium next year. Among those attending the festivities were FIFA president Gianni Infantino and Confederation of African Football president Ahmad. Infantino said he was impressed with the level of investment into Mazembe. He was particularly impressed with the Moise Katumbi Academy and plans for the new stadium. On Wednesday evening, Ahmed, Infantino and Katumbi took part in a commemorative march that also featured African legends Samuel Eto'o and Kalusha Bwalya at TP Mazembe's current stadium. Katumbi was recently named by FIFA as vice president of the newly formed World Football Club Association. In a related development, a FIFA president, Gianni Infantino, while talking in Lubumbashi during Mazembe's 80th anniversary, announced plans to raise $1 billion to build at least one stadium meeting FIFA standards in each African country. He said FIFA wants African football to shine and will work with CAF and other stakeholders to improve refereeing, infrastructure, and competitions on the continent. Finally, in World Athletics, Labour Road Race action this weekend, Ethiopian Mulu Seboka and Dereje Debele broke the course records at the SCO Kameng International Marathon, a World Athletics bronze Labour Road Race in the southwestern Chinese city on Sunday. Seboka broke the previous course record set 3 years ago by Kenyan Rhoda Chepkorir. In Singapore, Prisca Cherono successfully defended her title at the Singapore Marathon, taking more than 3 minutes off the course record at the World Athletics Gold Labour Road Race on Saturday. Fellow Kenyan Joshua Kipkorir also retained his title, winning the men's race in 2 hours, 19 minutes and 13 seconds. In the men's race, Joshua Kipkorir finished inside the course record of 2 hours, 11 minutes and 25 seconds, set 10 years ago by 2007 world champion Luke Kibet. Solomon Mutai of Uganda followed just 34 seconds later to finish second, and Bahrain's former 1500 meters specialist Benson Serue took third place in 2 hours, 20 minutes and 22 seconds. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. 8 Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. You're hearing from Chidima featuring Flavor with 40 Years. Ahmed Chokey featuring Pitbull. What come next with Habibi, I Love You. And then Aja Sumanko concludes with Kokabere.
Try to toast me. I'm married to the game, but the game don't love me. It'll leave me in a heartbeat. That's why I'm cold-blooded. When I say I love you, I mean it deeply. I can't see life without you living with me. And if you love someone, I know you feel me. When I say before they take you, they gon' have to kill me. I'm talking they gon' have the Army, Marine, Navy SEAL me. Yeah, the world knows
So tell that dealer he gon' have that deal with me. Even when you're gone, I'ma hunt you like a Chris Webber timeout final four. So till the sky comes crashing down, world falls apart, till death do its part, you my heart for sure.
Habibi, I love you, I need you. Habibi, ghanini w khallini maak. Habibi, I love you, I need you. Habibi, dwebni w nar
sema tutachana ongeza nipenda zaidi ya jana wakitamani tuzunike tufanye sherehe mimi nipete na kama jana wanatamani
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Quite recently, French troops in a combat exercise lost 13 soldiers in the fight against jihadists in the Sahel. This news was received with great concern in France, and the question was raised as to whether France was carrying an heavier burden alone in the fight against the jihadists. President Macron took the lead in quelling the public's concern with the encouraging news that the European states were rallying behind France's fight in the Sahel. But we should not forget that returning body bags from Africa to Europe or the Western world has always been a serious political problem, and often they have resulted in the retreat of Western Europe from Africa. So what then should the Africans do in the circumstances when France or the European powers will withdraw from the African fight against jihadists? Of course, France and other Western powers have interest in the Sahel and in Africa that they want to defend. And it would not be easy for them just to turn their back against these interests in Africa. But African leaders must be realistic and to envisage a time when the concerns in Europe might be so overwhelming that political leaders may not have the luxury of maintaining military troops in the Sahel of Africa. Let us not forget what happened a few years ago in the United States when it was discovered that some American troops had been killed in the Sahel. There was a political concern and questions were raised as to why these troops were deployed in Africa. When it was explained, then there was a suggestion that they pulled back. Now, the African Union, if they had not yet done so, should seize this opportunity to begin serious study as to what Africa could do in the event Africa is left alone to fight the jihadists. And let us not make any mistake. The jihadist threat is a serious one. Not only is Mali or Burkina Faso bearing the brunt of this threat, we are hearing news from many Africans living in remote villages in the Sahel that they are constantly under the threat of the jihadists, and many of them are moving out. So the insecurity is there for all to see. We should also take into account that at the beginning of the Mali situation, after the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime, the African states, particularly ECOWAS, did try to intervene to assist Mali being a member of ECOWAS. Regrettably, when ECOWAS went to the Security Council asking for assistance for finance and logistics, they were in a way gently rebuffed, and this led to France's involvement in Mali and the Sahel in 2014. But despite this, Africans, for their own concern, should begin to think seriously as to what they should do. In this connection, it would be advisable for the African Union not to assume, as some Africans may want to do, that just withdrawing Europeans from the fight in the Sahel might minimize the jihadist threat. There's no evidence for that. If you take into account the jihadist threats in Somalia, the jihadist threats in eastern Kenya, or in Nigeria and Cameroon. So this is an African problem, and it should be tackled by Africans themselves. This is the time when Africans have to weigh the issue of self-reliance or the norm of excess dependency. In a sense, this is the time for an agonizing reappraisal of the African Union security output to see what advice it could give to the rest of Africa. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nelson Lopez, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, in the ocean, one does not need to sow water. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa. We'll be right back.